Could there be a new conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan? There's been renewed fighting in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. That's despite a ceasefire signed 2 years ago. But will the truce hold? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Armenia and Azerbaijan are blaming each other for renewed fighting near the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. The area is recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but it's mostly controlled by ethnic Armenians. The latest violence has triggered calls for calm from Russia, NATO, and the European Union. Azerbaijan's military says Karabakh fighters targeted its positions in a district under the supervision of Russian peacekeepers. Two Karabakh troops and an Azerbaijani soldier were killed. Nagorno-Karabakh's leader then announced a partial military mobilization. Azerbaijan accused Armenia of breaking the 2020 ceasefire.
The Republic of Azerbaijan has repeatedly stated that the presence of Armenian armed forces and illegal Armenian armed formations in the territories of Azerbaijan, where Russian peacekeepers are temporarily stationed, remains a source of danger contrary to the joint statement. The demilitarization of those territories, the complete withdrawal of Armenian troops, and the disarmament of illegal Armenian armed detachments are absolutely necessary.
Armenia's prime minister responded by saying Azerbaijan has repeatedly violated the ceasefire. Nikol Pashinyan also criticized the role of Russian peacekeepers.
The continuous and deteriorating violations of the ceasefire regime along the contact line, the cases of physically and psychologically intimidating the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh in the presence of peacekeepers are simply unacceptable. It's becoming very necessary to clarify the details of the peacekeeping operation in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Hostilities involving Nagorno-Karabakh go back decades. Azerbaijan and Armenia fought a six-year war that ended in a ceasefire in 1994. In 2016, an outbreak of violence killed dozens of people during 4 days of fighting. While the conflict in 2020 killed more than 5,000 people, including both soldiers and civilians. In November that year, a Russian-brokered ceasefire ended the six-week conflict. Russian troops were then deployed. In April, the Armenian and Azerbaijani leaders agreed to hold talks mediated by the EU. A month later, thousands of Armenians protested against their prime minister for making what they called unacceptable concessions to Azerbaijan. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests in Yerevan, Richard Girigosian, director of the Regional Study Center. In Istanbul, Matthew Breiza, a former U.S. ambassador and mediator on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. He's also a board member at the Jamestown Foundation. And in Baku, Fariz Ismailzadeh, vice rector at the Azerbaijan Diplomatic Academy. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us on Inside Story today. Fariz, let me start with you today. From your vantage point, has the peace process totally broken down at this point?
Not totally, but there's a big disappointment because almost 2 years have passed since the end of the war. And the peace plan which Azerbaijan offered Armenia, consisting of mutual recognition of territorial integrity, opening of the borders, delimitation of the borders, has not been accepted by Armenia. Armenia keeps delaying the peace process, and no substantial progress has been made on opening of communication and transport lines, as well as recognition of territorial integrity of both countries. So there's a big disappointment in Baku, and frequent violations of ceasefire by illegal Armenian troops. Most recently, 4 days ago, Azerbaijani soldier has been killed. They show that these illegal criminal groups, illegal gangs, still pose a big threat to the regional security. So that is the main reason for pessimism and for frustration in Baku, as well as in many European capitals.
And Richard, from your perspective, do you think that there could be a whole new conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan? And did this latest escalation come as a surprise?
Well, in many ways, I'm concerned. I'm concerned largely because this represents the most serious escalation of hostilities since the fragile ceasefire of 2020. What worries me as well is the broader context. Azerbaijan's attacks are not limited to targeting Armenian forces in Nagorno-Karabakh. This is an Azerbaijani challenge to Russia and the presence of the Russian peacekeepers, meaning that the implications of a widening of this conflict are significant. Nevertheless, Armenia, I think, needs to recommit to diplomacy. Armenia and Azerbaijan need to reassert that there is no resolution by military force. Diplomatic negotiations are the only way forward.
Matthew, this latest violence has triggered calls for calm from Russia, from NATO, from the European Union. What steps can be taken now to de-escalate the situation?
Yeah, I mean, those parties are almost always calling for de-escalation and getting back to negotiations. So specifically what can happen? I hope there's a recognition by both sides, as you could hear from both Fariz and Richard, that, you know, nobody wants further conflict. B, Azerbaijan's response, or from Richard's, maybe his perspective, if they think Azerbaijan maybe initiated this round of fighting, but it ended and it was limited. And, you know, condolences to the three troops that were killed, but it was limited and quite emphatic. So hopefully this round is finished. So what needs to happen, I think, is that Prime Minister Pashinyan needs to feel the political strength to go forward and not only finish implementation of the November 10th ceasefire statement, which calls for all the Armenian troops to depart, calls for many other things too, but also to move toward a negotiation on a border delimitation between Azerbaijan and Armenia, their international border, I mean, and a final peace treaty for Karabakh to settle the conflict once and for all. I believe that Prime Minister Pashinyan really wants to do that, as do I believe President Aliyev wants to. But as you showed in your opening package, as soon as Pashinyan said he'd sit down, or his foreign minister would sit down with his counterpart, there were street protests in Armenia. So Pashinyan has been he's been painted by his political opposition as committing treason by agreeing to the ceasefire and then wanting to move ahead in normalizing relations with Azerbaijan and restoring Armenia's transportation contacts with Azerbaijan to lead to a state of economic normalcy. So what really needs to happen is that political standoff in Armenia needs somehow to get worked through.
Richard, let me ask you about something that Matthew was just bringing up. There is a lot of anger in Armenia being directed toward Prime Minister Pashinyan. There was anger that was being directed toward him even after the ceasefire agreement was finalized, because as part of that agreement, Armenia had to give up swaths of territory that it had controlled for decades. How much anger is still being directed toward the Prime Minister now, and how much is that impacting his ability to actually finalize a peace agreement?
Well, in many ways, what we see is lingering opposition, yes, but ineffective opposition, definitely. Much of the street demonstrations have failed to attract significant numbers. Moreover, unlike Azerbaijan, Armenia is a much more vibrant democracy. Armenian government under Prime Minister Pashinyan has won re-election in a second free and fair election last summer. There is a rare degree of legitimacy in Armenia, which does reassure and also gives us hope to find a negotiated way out of this crisis.
Fariz, where do things stand right now when it comes to the government of Azerbaijan, when it comes to signing a final peace agreement? What is the stance of the government?
I think the vision that Azerbaijani government has and has declared since 2020 is that the region should be a region of peace, security, cooperation, mutual integration of economies. That's why Azerbaijan offered Armenia to open the communication lines, transport lines. Azerbaijan is investing a lot into the construction of the Karabakh liberated areas. Many railways, airports are being built. So the vision is that we should achieve long-lasting and durable peace. But unfortunately, there are obstacles still ahead of us. One of them is that still illegal Armenian troops are located in areas which are controlled by Russian peacekeepers. And the second problem is that Armenia refuses the peace treaty. So these are the problems that are still ahead of us. And Azerbaijan is insisting that peace treaty should be signed and that borders should be opened and trade and communication lines should be restored. In fact, if you look at the infrastructure, Azerbaijan already finished many highways and railways, but Armenia still keeps delaying the construction on their own part.
Richard, I saw you reacting to some of what Fares was saying there. Did you want to jump in?
Well, yes, I do want to offer one clarification. The armed forces, the military units present in Nagorno-Karabakh, are not under the control or command of Armenia proper. These are local units of the democratically elected Nagorno-Karabakh leadership. So there is an important distinction. It's also a recognition of the limits of Armenian influence and control. What we're focused on in Armenia is much more the implementation of the terms of the ceasefire agreement as a foundation toward an eventual peace treaty or agreement. But it's difficult to disagree with Fares because we share the same goals and objectives of regional peace and stability. Nevertheless, I do think the recent attacks, the recent fighting in the past days have only demonstrated the imperative for greater engagement by the West, by the European Union, to facilitate diplomatic engagement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And I do think the blaming the victim approach will not work.
Fares, I saw you just now reacting to what Richard was saying, so I'm going to give you a chance now to go ahead and jump in.
Yes, I just wanted to say that it's not exactly true that the forces in Karabakh are only belonging to local population. There's many evidences that buses and other trucks are transporting Armenian soldiers from Republic of Armenia to Karabakh. And even some of those videos show that our soldiers themselves acknowledging that. So this is not exactly true that Karabakh is fighting for its own. And then also this soldier, that Azerbaijani soldier that was killed 4 days ago, this is what triggered the response from Azerbaijani side. So these shootings and violations are constantly happening towards Azerbaijani servicemen as well as Azerbaijani civilians doing reconstruction work in Karabakh.
Matthew, there are analysts who have said that while Russia has the most influence in attempting to keep the peace in the region, its resources are being stretched because of the war in Ukraine. Has the Russian peacekeeping effort in Nagorno-Karabakh been impacted by the war in Ukraine? And if so, how much?
Yeah, I think it has to have been. I mean, it's difficult to, you know, measure something that's a lack of activity or a lack of further conflict, right? I'm going to quantify that, but Russia's reputation has been devastated as a mediator, right? I mean, if it has invaded not only Ukraine twice recently, but also neighboring Georgia, its prestige as a peacemaker or peacekeeper is quite diminished. Already, Russian peacekeepers have a terrible reputation from the way they've behaved in Georgia and in Moldova, where they've stirred tension rather than kept the peace, and they've been creating pieces of countries rather than peace. Having said that, I think the Russian peacekeepers have performed pretty well so far. There was an instance shortly after the November 2020 ceasefire statement that could have spun out of control, and Russian forces redeployed and were able to defuse the situation. But yeah, the Russian military is terribly stretched. And as we know, estimates are that of the 150,000 troops that were arrayed against Ukraine as of February 24th, 75,000 have suffered casualties, according to the British Ministry of Defense, either deaths or injuries. And Russia has been moving troops from the Far East into Ukraine. So of course, that has an impact on how robust the Russian peacekeeping operation could be. But again, it's done a pretty good job. I think it would be great, though, if maybe the Turkish presence was augmented in terms of keeping eyes and ears on the Russian forces. There's a very small Turkish peacekeeping contingent in Agdam at a joint peacekeeping observation center. And I think also it's really important that the European Union plays an increasingly significant role in the negotiations between the leadership, mm-hmm. even if not in peacekeeping.
Well, Matthew, you bring up the EU there, and of course the EU is presenting itself as a potential mediator. In fact, in May, the EU hosted Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev in Brussels. That was the second time that they've been hosted there for talks on how to avert future clashes. Do you believe that there were encouraging signs that came out of those talks?
Yeah, there definitely was. And it looked like the two leaders Armenia and Azerbaijan, you know, found a certain degree of chemistry and wanted to move ahead with the various agreements after November 2020, in particular an agreement from January 11th, 2021, that called for joint projects, infrastructure projects, to be developed jointly among Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia. But then there was the backlash in Armenia. Richard is right that Armenia is a vibrant democracy, that Nikol Pashinyan his political movement won a resounding victory a year ago in June, which helped him consolidate his strength against his opponents. But nonetheless, precisely because Armenia is a vibrant democracy, there are these forces in Armenia that still haven't quite come to grips with the fact that this military conflict is over and it's time to move forward, as all wars end, with a diplomatic negotiation and hopefully a lasting peace.
Richard, what do you think about how effective the EU can be in all this? I mean, can they be particularly effective if they don't have any presence on the ground?
Well, to be honest, they already have been effective. The EU has been able to not mediate, but facilitate, providing a platform for Armenia and Azerbaijan to engage. And fortunately, EU engagement is much less provocative than, say, US engagement or NATO expansion in terms of the Russian reaction. And in this context, where we're going in terms of post-war stability is an endorsement of EU principles of engagement, connectivity, a peaceful resolution to inherently political conflicts. So I think the EU, and only the EU, is best positioned to leverage the synergy of political will going forward. What's most important, though, I do think, is the need to engage diplomatically with the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. For example, Armenia-Azerbaijan's bilateral issues are important, but quite separate from the security and safety of the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. So I do think we need to broaden and deepen the peace process.
Fariz, I want to take a step back and look for a moment with you at the Russian peacekeeping efforts. How effective do you think that they have been?
Generally, they have been quite effective, I would say, because they are helping to preserve stability and security, and not many huge cases of violations of ceasefire have taken place. But of course, there were some questions to them as well from Azerbaijani side. For example, when some illegal Armenian soldiers were transported from Armenia, Republic of Armenia, it has been disappointing to see that Russian peacekeepers allow that. There has also been some high-level politicians, including even French presidential candidates, who have managed illegally to visit Karabakh. This is not very welcomed by Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan considers this as part of its territorial integrity, and therefore Russian peacekeepers should abide by international law. Well, I believe that in the future there will be opportunities to improve the work of Russian peacekeepers. Most importantly, in terms of making sure that illegal Armenian groups and, let's say, military groups will be finally withdrawn from the Karabakh, as it is stipulated by November ceasefire agreement or trilateral statement of the leaders.
And Fariz, if I could just follow up with you, you know, you have on the one hand what the Russians are doing, and then you have these mediation attempts by the EU. The fact that there seem to be dual tracks right now, does that complicate the situation more?
Not so much. I would say they complement each other, because EU mostly offers financial and economic incentives. They're offering a package for reconstruction of the area, humanitarian assistance, demining activities, trust-building activities, issues related to infrastructure, developing border delimitation. Russians are more focusing on hard security and making sure that violations of ceasefire don't take place. So I think they're mutually complementary. Even Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs has said that they don't feel any, let's say, danger or hesitation by EU involvement. So I think that there are both positive tracks at the same time.
Richard, it looked to me like you were nodding along a moment ago. Did you want to jump in?
Yes, I agree with Fariz very much, because what we see is a unique paradox where, despite Russian aggression, despite Russia's unjustified invasion of Ukraine, its previous invasion of Georgia. What the Russian peacekeepers represent is a rare guarantee of security and safety on the ground. With EU engagement, what we also see, to use Fariz's words, a complementary, not a contradictory approach, because EU engagement will only tend to legitimize what was a unilateral Russian peacekeeping deployment. Because after all, even the ceasefire agreement was crafted by Russia and imposed by Russia. Nevertheless, it's the best we have on the ground.
Matthew, how much concern is there right now that the fighting could get worse? And how unstable might things get in the region if that plays out that way?
Personally, I'm not so concerned that this fighting is going to spin out of control. I think that neither President Aliyev nor Prime Minister Pashinyan want that to happen. I think Pashinyan wants to desperately to do, well, what Richard has been kind of suggesting, which is have Karabakh be gaining some sort of a legal status at the negotiating table that is other than unequivocally part of Azerbaijan. This is the core of what remains to be negotiated. From Azerbaijan's perspective, that's impossible. You know, the military phase of the war ended, and there was a possibility for the status of Nagorno-Karabakh to be on the table, and Prime Minister Pashinyan didn't agree to that. But now Pashinyan, I think, is saying, well, we do want to negotiate that point. And as well as, by the way, the French foreign minister on the day that Azerbaijan signed the ceasefire statement said the same thing, that status ought to be back on the table. So this is the big issue, I think. It's a political legal issue. I don't think either side wants to resume large-scale military operations, but there are those who wish to stir the pot. Russia is not among those, and the national leaders, I think, of Armenia and Azerbaijan are not among those people.
So, Matthew, if both sides, as you said, you know, really are eager to eventually sign some kind of treaty, a formal peace agreement, why has it been so difficult to try to, you know, broker this?
I think it's simply the case that there is fear on the Armenian leadership side that there's such a, maybe not huge, as Richard was saying, but vocal opposition that even has included physical threats to Pashinyan's survival, where he is deemed, again, to be a traitor to Armenia for having signed the agreement. So you remember back in the late 90s, there was a horrible incident when there were also, there was some movement toward a Karabakh settlement where there was an assassination on the floor of the parliament of Armenia that led to the deaths of the then prime minister and speaker of parliament. So, you know, Armenian politics can get quite dicey. And I think even though the national leader might want to move ahead, he knows his history. He's being careful.
But Matthew, just also very quickly, I mean, you ultimately think that this will be finalized and that this, a treaty will actually be signed?
I do think so. I don't know when, though. The timing depends entirely on how quickly the national debate in Armenia moves ahead to one of saying, okay, the war is over. We need to settle once and for all and integrate our economy back into the region versus those who say we will never give up. It's humiliation to even believe that we would trade the blood of our fallen compatriots and the independence or the sovereignty of Karabakh for some economic benefits. That debate still has to play out in Armenia, but I think the momentum is moving in favor of a peace treaty, as evidenced by Pashinyan's political victory in a year ago June's parliamentary elections.
All right, well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave our conversation there today. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Richard Girgosian, Matthew Bryza, and Fariz Ismailzadeh. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the entire team here in Doha, bye for now.